I'm Richard Hirschberger. I am the next speaker on the evolution of the rules. As is the nature of these creatures, I do have a book that I'm flogging, so... it's from Roman and Littlefield. They do have a table in the vendor's room. I will be there at 3 o'clock for book signing or meeting and greeting. I'm a 19th century guy. So this is a great topic for 19th century guys because that's when most of the action was in the development of the game. So what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be going from the general to the specific, depending on how time holds out. The general... is from a rules perspective, we can divide baseball up into these four distinct eras. The pre-modern era before up to the 1840s, the Knickerbocker Club era, 45 to 57. In 57, they had this big convention, revised the rules thoroughly. And then you go into this period... into the early 1890s, when the rules were changing every year practically. Just year to year, you'd have to look up what are the rules this year. Sometimes the changes were minor, sometimes they were huge. And then in 1893, you enter this period of stability. And there's a good reason why Sabre uses 1893 kind of as its definition of the modern period. That's when the pitcher is now at his modern distance. They don't actually have a mound yet, but the pitcher is at the modern distance, and mostly the rest of the rules are staying the same. And I'm going to be talking about why that is a little later. But in the period of the rapid change, you have the 1857 convention. That came out because you had this body of clubs in the New York metropolitan area, and it was this competitive cauldron. And they were looking for any edge they could find to win, or if they couldn't win, find an edge to not lose, because a draw was an option at that time. And the rules up to that point really weren't up to the task. They had not been designed with that competitiveness in mind. So the convention of 1857 kind of set off, that's the first year where we can say these are the official rules agreed on by an official body. And that has been true ever since, though sometimes you have more than one official body, so that can get confusing. The early game, and by early, I mean 1840s, early 50s, you can compare it to slow pitch softball. It's not entirely accurate, but it gives you an idea of what's going on. Then they discovered fast pitch softball. It was still underhand, but you get this period when the pitchers are trying to zip the ball in as fast as they can. And that's what I call the first pitching revolution. And you have a series of rule changes to deal with that. Pitchers were favoring speed over control, so that's why they introduced base on balls. Base on balls was not an original feature of the game, but that was a direct result of pitchers trying to throw so hard that they didn't really know where it was going to go. Around 1870, you have the fielding revolution. This is Harry Wright. This is the Cincinnati Red Stockings. And why were the Red Stockings so good? We all know about the Red Stockings, and it was 150 years ago, so it's kind of in our mind for that reason also. But you have to, what were they doing that was better? And it wasn't that they were inherently better players. And the New York press looked at these guys, and they were mostly New Yorkers. So the New York press knew who these guys were. They knew what they could do. And they said, on paper, this is a pretty good team, but not a great team. And the reason it was a great team is because Harry Wright, the manager, was a thinker. And he had been thinking out how to do fielding better. And again, to oversimplify things a bit, fielding before then was the batter hits the ball, you have one guy who's going to go get the ball, and you have eight guys standing and watching him do it. And Wright was the guy who realized that that wasn't the way to do it, that every player in the field has a role to play. And that was revolutionary. So suddenly, when you look at why scoring goes down, because the fielders were in the right places more than they had been before. Then in 1875 to 85, the second pitching revolution, and that is the curveball. And I could go into some detail about why that developed when it did, but time prevents. So just take my word for it that some developments in the rules allowed for curveballs to be pitched, but they originally were underhand curveballs. And you know, anybody who knows fast pitch softball knows you can throw a curveball underhand. Softball pitchers do it all the time. You can't really make it a dominant pitch. So pitchers started cheating their delivery upward. So starting from full underhand, you start to go three-quarter underhand. It is illegal, but the umpires don't have the rules, tools to really prevent it. So what happens is the rules actually are a lagging indicator. If you can go year by year in this period and see what the rule says is a legal pitch and assume that pitchers were actually doing higher than that. And eventually, 1884 for the National League, 85 for the American Association, they threw in the towel. So if somebody tells you they started throwing overhand in 1884, no, they were throwing overhand in 1883. It's just, you know, at some point you need to recognize the inevitable. All the rule changes after that were dealing with this new pitching. And that's why you start to see pitching delivery restrictions, the modern set positions defined in 1887. That's all dealing with it. And the number of balls for a base on ball starts coming down lower and lower and lower to try to compensate for better pitching. All right, now I want to talk about classes of problems. You change the rule because there is a problem that needs to be fixed. So what do you consider a problem? That's an ideological statement. You know, if we say the games are too long, that is an ideological statement about how long a game should be. Well, it turns out that that is the oldest complaint about baseball. Baseball fans have always said that the game takes too long. It's a paradox. We love the game, but we want to get home. So over and over again, rule changes are made to either shorten the game or speed up the pace of play, which is not quite the same thing, but they're related. The second most common type of problem is, again, an ideological idea of how high scoring should be. And that has changed over the years. In the 1860s, scores were in the double digits routinely, and nobody thought that was a problem. But as fielding got better, then pitching got better, scores start coming down. By around 1880, you're looking at essentially modern scoring levels. And there was a lot of concern that scoring was going too low. Because, you know, if you can have a 1-0 game, that means you can have a 0-0 game, and where do you go from there? So a lot of the rule changes in that period were to try to bring the scoring level up a little bit more. The third class is give the umpire a break. There was only one umpire in that era. He had a really tough job, and he was out of position for a lot of plays. So a lot of you might know that through a lot of the 19th century, there were two strike zones. There was a high strike zone and a low strike zone. So the batter would go up to the plate and say, I want a low strike zone. So is a ball at this level, is that a ball or a strike? It depends. It depends on which strike zone you called for. The problem was, what about a ball there? Is that high or low? And you know, there was no clear division between the high and the low strike zone, so that worked out about as well as you'd expect. That's why the high and the low strike zones were eliminated. And it seems like a ridiculously quaint feature of the game, but that's why. And then other is just, there's all sorts of miscellaneous. I talked about this out of order. I'm sorry, I went out of order. So this is the rules playing catch-up. I talked about how the arm delivery started cheating upward. I'm not going to read them. You can read them quickly. what you'll see is that the official definition keeps on moving a little bit higher until they've thrown in the towel. That's the decline in runs per nine innings from 1871 to 2015 was the present when I made this graph. If I were to carry it forward, it would be about the same. So you can see how scoring was much higher. It came down. It roughly stabilized. If that were to change, the MLB would sit up and take notice. Here is a timeline showing the number of balls for a walk. This is the response to that falling scoring. So in 1875, which is the early history of the base on balls is complicated, but in 1875, it's basically like we have today, except that it was nine balls for a walk. They originally said three balls for a walk, so they stuck to it saying, well, you need to get three bad pitches to get a ball, then three balls for a walk. So, okay, that's nine. The reason they kicked it up to nine was, again, for the umpire's benefit, because they were having trouble prior to then to get umpires to actually call balls. It was such a new concept, and it seemed such a bizarre concept, that there was a lot of resistance to it. So they make it nine balls so that calling a ball is no big deal. At that point, they have a tool as scoring keeps on coming down to lower the number of base on balls that requires that walk. So that's the timeline we have there. You'll notice 1887, they're down to five balls for a walk, and they kick it up to four strikes for an out. That's the only year. That was the basis. That's the name of my book, is Strike Four, and 1887 is how I justify the name. I chose the name because it's cool. 1887 was the year that they eliminated the high and low strike zones. So suddenly the strike zone is twice the size that it used to be. And they recognized that would give a big advantage to the pitcher. So they added a strike to the out to try to compensate for that. It never was popular, so they removed it the following year. But if you read 1887 accounts, sometimes you do a double take. Even I've read lots of 1887 game accounts, and sometimes I do a double take when I see a strike four. So the base on balls was one tool that they had to counter improved pitching. Another tool that they had was to just move the pitcher back. That's a topic that's under discussion today. So the pitcher was in a box. It was when I say box, think like a batter's box, but for the pitcher. And originally, the front line of the box was 45 feet from the plate. So in 1880, they move it back 5 feet. 1887, they require the pitcher to have his rear foot on the back line of the box, and he can only take one step. That's the set position. The windup position came later, and it was essentially pitchers cheating again, until finally they just said, okay, fine, we'll put it in the rules that you can do that. So 1893, up to that point, the pitcher is still in a box, but it doesn't actually serve any purpose because he's told where he has to put his back foot and he can take one step. The box doesn't need to be there anymore. So 1893, they moved him back another 5 feet and they get rid of the box. But of course, we still talk about the box. We say the pitcher was knocked out of the box, and that's a vestige. That's where we get that from. And a pro tip, if you want to talk about 19th century baseball, eliminate the word mound from your vocabulary. It's a rookie mistake. If you talk about where the mound was, I will look down my nose. All right, now I want to give, very quickly, a specific example of a rule change, the foul strike. And the word foul strike has been used several different ways, but I mean it here in the sense that a foul ball is counted as a strike. So I will read this one for you. This is from 1886, an account that Kelly, that's King Kelly, has this season made frequent use of a trick. That's Kelly for you. Tricks and Kelly go together. He has only recently perfected. He simply puts his bat in the way of a fair ball and knocks a wide foul. He has done this as frequently as 7 or 8 times in succession, and it usually rouses the ire of the pitcher to such an extent that he gets rattled and goes to pieces or tires him out. And the wily Mike gets a base on balls or finds a nice soft ball that he can hit effectively. There is nothing in the league rules prohibiting the play, and it must be decidedly disgusting to the man in the box. All right, so you have Kelly, and he wasn't the only guy. Other guys picked it up with just fouling ball, fouling ball, fouling ball. So in 1887, they redefined a strike to include any obvious attempt to make a foul hit. Well, what's the problem with that rule? what's obvious? So the American Association declared that if it was a bunt and it went foul, it was obvious. Of course, that's not true. You might be bunting to try to do a sacrifice. So there was a lot of pushback from the National League against the idea. But that still leaves the problem that the umpire has to decide what is obvious. So here is from 1893, Cap Anson says, at present it is within the jurisdiction of the umpire to say just what the intention of the batter is when he strikes such a foul. And the consequence is that strikes are never inflicted as punishment, even when the foul is made deliberately. Umpire was a tough job. One guy, fans threw beer bottles in those days. So if he could avoid grief, he would avoid grief. So, 1894, the strike is changed again to any obvious attempt to make a foul hit, same as the old rule, but also a foul hit other than a foul tip made by the batsman while attempting a bunt hit that falls or rolls upon the ground between home base and first base or home base and third base. So, in other words, they've codified the idea that a foul bunt, a bunt hit that goes foul is a strike, but they still leave for non-bunts the option that the umpire still has to read a mind. Before the foul strike rule went into force, the question almost invariably addressed to the umpire when he called a strike on a batsman on a foul was, how did you know I fouled the ball intentionally? And then there was sure to be a great amount of strife and argument. If there was no strike called, then the pitcher and catcher and a few others would gather around the home plate, and there would be more chin music. You can't win. There's no winning scenario here. So in 1901, we get the modern rule. I'm not going to read it to you because I'm going to assume that you know the modern rule. But it's a conglomeration of these existing rules. They keep the bunt part in place, but they expand the rule so that any foul hit is a ball, is a strike. With the exception of a bunt with two strikes is a compromise. It's still objective, and that's the important thing to the umpire. He doesn't need to read a mind, but there's a compromise about how severe we're going to make this rule. I'm going to jump ahead. I want to show you this cartoon because the rule was really controversial, very controversial. The closest thing to your experience is talking about the DH. It was that controversial. And so this was a cartoon in the Cincinnati Post about the fan reaction. The reason I use this as my example is because we're having really similar discussions today. When I wrote my book, I did a chapter about what's going to happen, what future rule changes do I see on the horizon. And my answer, this is writing a year and a half ago, was I don't think there's going to be... I think we're going to get the DH in the National League. I'm not advocating it. I'm just saying it's going to happen. We're going to get robocalls of the plate, balls and strikes. Again, I'm not advocating it. I'm saying it's going to happen. And I said in my book, I don't think there's really going to be too much more than that. Then you all read the news. We're going to see this again. We're going to see this fan reaction. But... want to just throw a couple graphs at you. This graph shows the history of 20th century baseball, history of baseball over the last century. And this is not based on rule changes. The rules have essentially been unchanged. The dip you see there is the mound being lowered. Here's the other half. That's the same time period, home runs per nine innings. So look at those two graphs. The home run graph is messy. It's dirtier data, but it follows the same pattern. Yeah. Those three graphs are the history of baseball in the last 100 years. That little dip right at the very end, that was last season. When I first did that graph, I went, huh, if dirty data might mean nothing. Might keep on going up. If I had included this season up to date, it would be higher than ever. That is also higher than ever. Something's going to break. These cannot go on forever. So we're in really interesting time for rules. And gosh, I wish I had known about it when I wrote that last chapter.
So, home runs going way up, strikeouts going way up, starters innings going way down. You can fix it doing one thing, basically, deaden the ball.
I'm actually kind of a fan of deadening the ball, but that will not help strikeouts.
I think it will help strikeouts. I'm sorry, are you interrupting me?
No, I'm going to
okay. Okay. No, it will bring down strikeouts because then pitchers, knowing that they won't get taken out of the park, will feel more comfortable bringing the ball into the zone, saying, here you go, hit the ball and get yourself out. You can't do that now because eight guys can take them out of the ballpark.
You may be right. When we talk about rule changes in the 20th century, we always talk about the DH and lowering the mound. And those address offense or defense. Right. But here we have to address both. And you may be right that deadening the ball will change the incentives enough, but I'm not persuaded, and it certainly won't happen right away.
Understood.
We will certainly have a period where you're still going to have one guy brought in to pitch the sixth inning, and he's going to throw as hard as he can for every batter.
That may be, but I think that will also result in longer outings by starting pitchers because, unlike now, when they have to throw as hard as they can on every single pitch to get swing and miss, now he won't have to. Now he can kind of lay up. He can then it'll be easier on his arm. He'll be able to go longer in the game.
You may be right. It'd be fascinating to see. We're going to see something. I don't know what it's going to be.
Maybe. Well,
you have a line behind you. We don't have much time.
We may not see something because baseball owns Rawlings, and they made the ball like it is this year. So that's flying out like this because they like the highlights of home runs and strikeouts. 60% of all the highlights on quick pitch on MLB Network is a home run or a strikeout. That markets the game. Anyway.
I will say that as a 19th century guy, in the 19th century, they talked about dead balls and live balls, and it had no air of conspiracy to it. It was a matter of strategy and doctrine, and I think that was very healthy. I think part of our problem today is we talk about the ball as if it's a sacred object that must be unchanged, so any talk about changing it must be done in secret, and we need to get away from that. Next gentleman.
This problem, which I call the contact crisis, is the topic of the Science in Baseball committee meeting this year, and I'll be doing a presentation on it. Here's a sneak preview. Adjusted R-squared, if you know what that means, that's the amount of the credit you can give to the cause of a phenomenon. The rise in strikeouts adjusted R-squared entirely fastball velocity and fastball frequency, which is declining, and that's strategy, that's game theory. And we have a solution, and actually Chuck's idea, one of the ideas of Chuck's, is incorporated into that solution. Come to the meeting, you're going to find out, and by the way, 92% of attendance is explained. A lot of the factors people think about the decline in attendance are not involved. It is the contact, the decline in contact. That's the crisis in the game. You'll learn about what's causing that, and you'll learn about the proposed solution, which I think is very workable. Come to that meeting. I only did this work in the last month.
Tell us when the meeting is.
Oh, so the meeting is Saturday afternoon at 3:15, I think, but check in your schedule.
Yep. All right, and one more.
Yeah, a couple things. One thing in general, I always think like change rules and has changed some is safety. We're always worried about safety, you know, concussions. You had the Buster Posey rule was one. You know, you don't know what else might come along. The thing when you talk about judgment, I always think of, which you can see whether or not it's safety, is throwing at a batter. Now we've got all this throwing, and the next guy throws at him, and the umpire has to throw. He throws them out. Every time you talk about, you know, the players arguing, I think like, yeah, why? Well, I wasn't throwing at him, you know, this and that. And I wonder if that's another thing which will eventually be somewhat codified into rules.
I'm not sure how they would do that, but it certainly is an issue. Any time when you are asking the umpire to know what was going on inside the player's head, that never goes well. So I expect that they will eventually work their way away from that, but I couldn't tell you how they're going to do it. Thank you for coming. Roman and Littlefield, they have a table in the vendor room.